It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic law.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the Supreme Leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to Islamic Laws, which is a special program for the month of Muharram and the questions related to this month and mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Sheikh Javid, the first question of today's program is about mourning and commemoration of the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in a way that it disturbs others. Now, it could be in a Muslim country, Shia country like Iran, Iraq, and Lebanon, some parts of Lebanon, or in a non-Muslim country. Now, there are different scenarios. For example, when you're talking about an Islamic country like Iran, all the people know that, it is the month of Muharram, and people are mourning for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and they accept that. But in some cases, we see that some people use some instruments in a way that it disturbs the neighbors, for example. And when we are talking about non-Muslim countries, maybe mourning in and of itself may disturb other people. Now, the question is that if mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam in one way or another disturbs others, is it permissible to do that?
Well, I should thank you for the explanation you gave, but the religious authorities have said that basically we should not disturb others, we should not create trouble or problem for others.
This is what we call it, haqqun nas, yes, the rights of the people.
Yes. There could be some ailing people in our neighborhood. There could be some people who suffer from chronic diseases. They need some rest. And of course, if we amplify the loudspeakers, the sound of the loudspeakers might actually disturb them, and it may create a headache for them. And instead of them getting attracted to Islam, they will begin to further go away from the religion. Now, we are speaking of Muslims living in non-Muslim countries, okay? So they will get even more alienated instead of getting interested in Islam.
That's true.
It's very important that we should not amplify the loudspeakers, or we have to turn in the loudspeakers use the loudspeakers within the four walls of the premises or the mosque or the Husseiniyah or wherever the majlis is actually going on, and the sound should not echo throughout the neighborhood, because it definitely will disturb. So if one does not know whether the sound will disturb or not, there's no problem.
That's true.
But if people from the neighborhood comes to the mosque or to the Husseiniyah asking people to lower the loudspeaker, then it's necessary to do this. It's haram to hurt other people, to create a nuisance for other people, or to disturb other people in the neighborhood.
And I believe we have in every city, we have special places like hospital, for example.
Hospitals.
For such places, it is more likely for the sound to disturb the people. So I believe those who, again, arrange these ceremonies need to take into consideration the place that they are choosing for holding mourning azadari for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
You're right.
So when it comes to such places, it's much better, not to choose the places which are closer to these places.
The hospitals. And I have been in some for example, in some countries where I've seen people mourning till 2 or 3 o'clock at midnight, midnight. At that time, people should be sleeping. Many people, even some Shia Muslims, might be sleeping. So it's not good to continue with the azadari until 3 o'clock a.m. or 2 a.m. because that's the time everyone should be asleep, okay? So that they can wake up for the Fajr prayer and can offer their prayers on time.
Unless it's a very if it is in a very private yes. place. There are only few people. For any reason, they like to continue mourning
yes.
for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they are awake till the morning. They are sure that they will say the morning prayer. Morning. They are not disturbing any person.
Yes.
What I've seen recently in some of the European countries is that, alhamdulillah, the Shias who are going to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, especially on the day of Ashura, they refer to the officials to take the permission mm-hmm. to have mourning procession for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
You're right.
I believe it's a very good action, because if it is done based on the laws of that country, mm-hmm. it means that the Shias, the Muslims, they are sensitive about not violating the rights of others and even the laws of a non-Muslim country.
You're right.
And they also, we see that they hold some banners and then, some booklets to explain to those people who are not familiar with this procession, to tell them what this procession is all about, what is the reason, who is Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and so on and so forth. And we see that it's, alhamdulillah, very effective for the people.
Yes. And it's very important to communicate the message of Imam Hussein to other people, even to the outsiders who are not familiar with the concept of Ashura. And this is already happening, as you said.
Okay, thank you, Sheikh Javid. Now, the other question for today's program is, especially, of course, it happened a lot before this pandemic, when we see that, especially on the day of Ashura or the night before that, in some communities, many people gather in one place to mourn for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, the question is that sometimes we see that because of the fact that it's not a big place, and both men and women, they like to take part in that, a special ceremony, it's likely for men and women to be in the same place. Now, the question is that if two non-mahram individuals' bodies touch each other during mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, for example, they are taking part in a procession for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, so is it problematic? Is it encouraged, discouraged? What is the viewpoint of the Supreme Leader about this question?
Well, as far as I know, none of the religious authorities allow such a thing to happen. You know, first of all, it's necessary that men and women should be segregated from, you know, men should keep a distance from women when walking in the streets, or when taking part in a procession, or when holding a religious ceremony. The segregation is an important thing that should take place. In the case of inevitability, when something is inevitable and men and women are mixed, like for example, when you go to Karbala, you see that men and women walk in the same streets, and that's not something avoidable, you know. They use the same road to walk to and from Haram. And that's not something the Iraqi authorities can do about it, nor the religious authorities can do anything about it. But there are some general instructions for the from the religious authorities. They have said that it's of course haram for for a man or a woman to deliberately make one's his body or her body come in contact with the body of a non-mahram. It is forbidden. But in the case of, involuntary, for example, if in the case of something happening involuntarily, unwantedly, unintentionally, there's no problem, because you did not mean to do it. You did not mean to touch someone's body, and of course it all happened as a matter of accident. Okay.
Yes, so but the point is that sometimes, let me give you a real example. For example, during the procession for Arba'een, that alhamdulillah millions of people, they are taking part in that. When they walk from Najaf to Karbala, there is enough space for men and women to walk.
Yeah.
But when they reach the holy city of Karbala, they reside in different places. There is no problem. But the Shia, the woman, for example, knows that if she is going to go to the holy shrine to visit the grave, for sure, her body will touch the body of a non-mahram. So I believe in this case, because she is sure about that,
She shouldn't go. Of course, she shouldn't.
So when we are talking about, unintentional, we are not talking about these cases. Because if she goes, it might be called unintentional. But because I believe she knew that already, it might be called intentional.
Yeah.
So they need to avoid that.
They
is that
should
true?
Avoid it. It. According to the religious authorities, they should not go into that. They should not walk into such gatherings when she's certain. For example, a woman, a Muslim woman, certain that she she will be touched, or her body might come in contact with the body of a non-mahram.
And so the same is true about the men, of course, because in the most of the cases, men are more in number. So we are giving the example of women going to these places. Yeah. Sheikh Javid, unfortunately, we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we'll continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred breath. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new land.
The light.
Dozens of baby turtles have made their way to the sea after an unexpected overnight hatch in Italy. Italian volunteers were surprised by track marks of the hatchlings from an unknown nest in Sicily. Some of the eggs hatched in the morning. An environmental group following the turtles' movement said that 74 hatchlings made it to the sea, while 5 didn't. The reptiles are an endangered species of oceanic turtle that also live in the Mediterranean Sea. Their population has declined in recent years due to hunting, loss of beach nesting sites, over-harvesting of their eggs, and being caught in fishing gear.
a Slovenian enthusiast has discovered a new cave in the Alpine country, which is staggering visitors by its awe-inspiring looks. Ludvik Husu, a 63-year-old cave explorer, has come across a cavern that runs 60 meters deep in the ground. It's located in the country's karst region, an area of land made up of limestone. Some 14,000 caves are buried under the green forest of Slovenia, hiding away breathtaking stalactite and stalagmite formations. The limestone region is so pristine and uncharted that the European Space Agency has used the caves to train astronauts.
Yeah, astronauts.
Astronauts also know that the karst world is exceptional, special in a similar way to how a space environment can be. It is an unknown environment where you do not know what to expect at your next step. They have been here to train for precisely that, how to help yourself in a dark area where you're not sure what's going on and everything is new. That's very good training for space, and they have been very pleased to be able to prepare for something they might find in space.
Over 150 species, some looking like alien creatures, have been discovered inside the cave systems. They include an ancient aquatic salamander called the little dragon that can live up to 100 years. The animal was previously considered living proof that dragons had once existed. Some cave systems in Slovenia stretch for tens of kilometers. They are so winding and deep that scientists say large parts of them remain undiscovered despite exploration efforts dating back hundreds of years. As the U.S. is experiencing its worst heat wave, Boston zookeepers are working extra hard to keep the animals cool to avoid overheating. Some get frozen treats, and some, like the yak, get a water hosing several times a day when the temperatures rise. The hardest part is cooling down animals belonging to cold climates, like the reindeer. Since reindeer don't like water, the hosing down is a big no. Instead, the poor animals sit in front of a desk fan all day to stay away from the heat. The birds have it a little easier as they spend most of their time in air-conditioned dens.
In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device.
We don't know much about woolly mammoths that went extinct some 10,000 years ago, except their scanned references in archaeology books. Now scientists have discovered that the giant mammals could walk incredibly long distance. Scientists from the University of Alaska have concluded that a male mammoth named Kik covered enough ground in its 28-year lifespan to encircle the Earth twice. To come up with the data, paleontologists analyzed one of Kik's well-preserved tusks. They say the animal lived with a herd through its infancy and youth and then went on to live alone. Scientists hope they will learn more about mammoths by analyzing further data from Kik's remains.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephant safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza Pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels, to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanian has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Our
artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite the tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into her obsession. An obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery bosses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
Late Shahidi is trying to convey one message by giving this title that after 50 years, meaning that we have to trace back all events that took place in the scene of Karbala after the demise of the Prophet, everything that took place.
The author mentions that this Ibn Sa'd is the son of Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, commander of the army of Islam at the time of the Holy Prophet. Now the late Sayyid Shahidi asks this question, okay, what happens that after less than 50 years, his son is standing against the grandson of the Holy Prophet and decides to kill him?
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, an analysis on the thoughts, works, and the biographies of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, jurisprudents, and scholars all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion. We want to continue our discussion regarding the book and the magnum opus of the late Sayyid Jafar Shahidi, that is After 50 Years. Hujjatul Islam Ziya Niya, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Hujjatul Islam Matawi, assalamu alaikum, brother, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, after 50 years, as we explained in the title, these 50 years or half of the century is the time that so many of the values of the pure Muhammadan Islam, Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, was violated. And unfortunately, getting to the scene of Karbala and the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and we can say his faithful companions. So, Hujjatul Islam Mahdawi, let's start with you, brother. According to Sayyid Jafar Shahidi in the book, After 50 Years, so many of the behaviors and the manners of these people, I mean the camp of battle, who killed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, were the same at the time of Jahiliyyah. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you said, brother, and we talked about this issue previously in our sessions that we had together, late Shahidi is trying to convey one message by giving this title that after 50 years, meaning that we have to trace back all events that took place in the scene of Karbala from the beginning, I mean after the demise of the Prophet, everything that took place from there till the moment we see actually Yazid is taking or benefiting from the fruits that people before him planted.
That's right.
One of the claims that he's trying to prove is that Muslim Ummah, or community, they changed throughout these 50 years their behavior, their custom, their culture, everything changed. I mean, every efforts that Prophet put forth and put forward in order to bring them a kind of prosperity, that if you take this path, you will reach the heaven. But this path was deviated.
That's right.
Mr. Shahidi, in order to prove that such a thing was existing even in the scene of Karbala, because we mentioned previously the thing during the time of the Khulafa, but during the time of Imam Hussein in Karbala, one of the things that he mentions and he is trying to prove is that people went back and start taking pride in their jahiliya adab,
That's
or
right.
custom that they would do during the time of jahiliya.
Okay.
One of these customs was to take pride in their tribe.
Oh.
But what Prophet was trying to tell them,
That's right.
brothers and sisters, your tribe has nothing to do with your prosperity or with your afterworld life.
This was what the aristocrats of the Quraysh at that time used to do, that we our blood is purer than you,
definitely,
this and that.
Definitely.
We have more money than you. Okay.
What in Quran, Allah is opposing this
yes.
idea, saying that the best of you is the more pious among you.
That's right.
It has nothing to do with your color, with your background, with your tribe. But during the time of Karbala in Ashura, one of the points and one of the events Mr. Shahidi is picking is saying that, okay, you look at the thing that took place during the day of Ashura.
Mm-hmm.
One day before the Ashura, we see Shemr, who is the killer or murderer of Imam Hussein. He is bringing safe conduct or al-aman. For whom? For Hazrat Abbas.
That's right.
He does not consider that Hazrat Abbas is the brother of Imam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the pure depicting of or picturing these tribal issues.
That's right.
Since Abbas is related through blood to my relatives, I'm going to take this aman for Abbas
oh.
and his brothers.
That's right.
That is manifestation of what?
That's right.
That everything that Prophet has worked so far.
That's right.
Put it aside,
okay.
and right now we are going to take back to all things that we have been doing before.
And of how not understanding the faithfulness of Hazrat Abul Fazl Abbas to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, as the respect that he had for his step-brother Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and all these things. As you said, that's right. If you take into the mind of Shamran that time, he's thinking about side things. Okay, I can bring a man to Abul Fazl Abbas, or maybe deceive him by money or something like that. He did not understand the pure religion.
Not considering that a revolution took place.
Oh.
Prophet has come. We have to put aside all those customs that
That's
we
right.
would do.
Okay.
And now I'm going to take this to whom?
Okay.
Somebody who's accompanying Imam Hussein
That's
in the
right.
Karbala.
That's right.
Expecting what? Expecting that he will be receiving, he will
oh.
be accepting, he will be cheering, saying
okay.
that, okay, thank you that you brought me such
okay.
a thing. It shows that it's
yes.
a kind of ignorance culture still existing in their hearts and minds.
But I think this was natural on that time, because most of the army of Ibn Ziyad on the other side were deceived by such things.
Yeah, definitely.
They were given the promises of ruling over different lands of Islam, or giving this and that from the public treasure and the Baytul Mal, and you know, all the tragedy took place. Okay, Hujjatul Islam Ziyani, let's get to you, brother. All these 50 years and making a ground in order. And we see corruption from the other side. We see islah, or the correction, from the side of Imam al-Hussein too. And the only way to correct them is through this movement, and through showing the true face through this movement and uprising, show that, oh people, look how much you are get used to this haram style of life, and get back to the pure religion of Islam. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, as you mentioned, the deviation that took place in the society of Islam needed a kind of surgery in the society.
Very good.
And sometimes people ask that why Imam Hussein alayhi salam was in need of this movement.
That's right.
Why he didn't leave, for example, Islamic society to mountains, to be with his followers and then get some people.
Right.
You know, I think that this idea is coming from a mind that does not have a good picture of the situation of that time.
That's right.
Because Wherever Imam alayhi salam wanted to go, these people were present. Mm-hmm. For example, another case that I want to mention it to highlight and to bold the issue that Sheikh Mahdavi also mentioned.
Very good.
For example, one of the figures that was guided is Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi.
That's right. He changed the camp from the battle to the hot one. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
But when Hur is martyred, mm-hmm. and Imam Hussein alayhi salam also is martyred.
Yes.
Hur was martyred for the sake of Imam Hussein alayhi salam to defend him. Mm-hmm. But at the evening of the 11th day of Muharram, when the army of Ibn Ziyad wants to leave the Karbala, they are having their bodies buried.
That's right.
And they are leaving the body of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam and his companions on the ground.
That's right.
Another scene is happening and taking place here that is showing us that the situation is completely the situation of Jahiliyyah. What is that? The family and the tribe of Hur come and they ask Ibn Sa'd to let them to bury the body of Hur. Mm-hmm. But they are burying him, mm-hmm. but they are leaving the body of Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam.
Oh.
So it shows that the priorities are changed.
Okay.
They are leaving the commander,
yes.
but they are thinking about their relative.
That's right. Okay.
So this is tribe.
Yes.
This is the relationships that the Holy Prophet did his best to cut.
That's right.
But after 50 years, we are seeing that they are much more powerful.
That's right.
In the society.
There is a famous sentence, they say, by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam towards the camp of Ibn Ziyad that your stomach or your bellies are full of haram mouthfuls. Okay? This is the case, I'll say, and haram earnings. Mm-hmm. You know, this type of behavior, the aristocrat life, living like a king and, you know, benefiting from all this mundane materialistic life have changed the behavior of the people.
You know, it's a kind of test also for people.
Oh, very
when
good.
We go through the book, for example, in chapter 24. Of
you
the
mean
book,
after 50 years?
Yes, the book after 50 years yes. by late Sayyid Shahidi.
That's right.
He mentions at the beginning of this chapter, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ أَحَسِبَ النَّاسُ أَن يُتْرَكُوا أَن يَقُولُوا آمَنَّا وَهُمْ لَا يُفْتَنُونَ. Does the believers think that if they just say, we believe in Islam, we don't have any test for them? This is not the case. So the author mentions that this Ibn Sa'd is the son of Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, mm-hmm. the commander of the army of Islam at the time of the Holy Prophet.
Yes.
Now the late Sayyid Shahidi asks this question, okay, what happens that after less than 50 years, his son is standing against the grandson of the Holy Prophet
oh.
and decides to kill him?
That's right.
And we have from Lady Zainab Salamullah alayha that Her Holiness says that, O Omar ibn Sa'd, a person like you is watching and the grandson of the Holy Prophet is going to be killed? Mm-hmm. It means that Lady Zainab Salamullah alayha does not want Omar ibn Sa'd to do this.
That's right.
And she does not believe in this.
That's right.
But Omar ibn Sa'd is neglecting these issues.
That's right.
Why? Because he had some promise from Ibn Ziyad to be the governor of Ray.
That's all right.
To be the, you know, ruler.
He was promised, but he I think he did not get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of Mukhtar's, you know, uprising against them. And but again, the case is that they were all called Muslims. You know, the case is this, that even the army that was in front of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam were Muslims, weren't they, Sheikh Mahdavi? They were called Muslims. They did prayer and salat on that time. And on their flags was the name of Prophet Muhammad. Isn't it?
Yes.
So you can be, by the time of Prophet Muhammad and by the time of the infallible Imams, but still do not understand Islam. And this is a rare case. This is the really a strange case. How much Satan and the satanic powers could be powerful that deviate you from the right path at the time of the leaving Imam.
Yeah, that is really important to pay attention to. And that's why we have to call the book of Mr. Shahidi a unique work. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's providing a noble analysis for the reader.
this analysis you pinpoint is very important.
Yeah, really important, because it is not only a history to read about the history and have a kind of analysis over the history. It's trying to say, oh, you reader,
that's right,
beware that you might be calling yourself as a Muslim.
That's right.
You might be claiming that you are Muslim, you are doing your prayer, but look at the situation. Look at different situation in your daily basis.
That's right.
What are you doing? Because at the time of the Prophet, at the time of the grandson of the Prophet, at the time of Imam Hussein, we had people who would call themselves believers. As you mentioned, in the day of Ashura, Umar ibn Sa'd is saying that, Ya Khair Allah. He's calling the army of Allah.
Yes.
And some of the people in the side of Imam Hussein would say that, what's going on over there? They are calling themselves such a people. They are doing their prayers, and then they are trying to kill the grandson of the Prophet.
Yes.
So I think one of the incentives which made late Shahidi to do such a work at that specific time, because at that time we had a lot of works being done with other outstanding personalities like Mr. Shariati, Mr.
Right.
Salehi Najafawadi.
Salehi Najafawadi,
yes.
That's right.
And even Allama Mutahhari. Yes. But Mr. Shahidi, he realized that every one of these people is looking at the uprising of Ashura from his point of view, but nobody is trying to give us a kind of analysis that we can apply in our daily life.
Very good. Okay.
When you read the work of Mr. Shahidi, which is not a very huge book, it's consisting of 200 pages,
yes,
but the novel analysis he provides in his book is helping the reader that he has to, first of all, look at his life. You see which side he will go if such a thing happens.
And we need this look, I think, we need this novel look even today.
Definitely.
Because the environment that was established at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam made all these people deviate from the right path and neglect the right of the Imam. And we know that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was not after the political power.
Another important point regarding this book is that Mr. Shahidi has written some other books regarding Karbala. But the subtle point about this book is that this book is written when the late Shahidi is at his 50s or 60s.
Oh.
So he is now a prominent scholar.
That's right.
And now with the, you know, this background of knowledge, as he mentions in the preface of the book, he says that this idea was in my mind, circulating in my mind for 20 years.
Wow.
And then I was thinking, and now I came to this conclusion to write this book. When he was writing this book, he was about 57 or something like 60 years old.
Okay.
So that's something...
A mature person who's writing a book and circulating the topic for 20 years, for sure he needs authentic references and resources and nice analysis, a novel analysis. May Allah bless his soul. He passed away in the year 1386 according to the solar calendar. His body was taken into Imamzada Abdullah in Shahr Rey, and he's buried over there. May Allah bless his soul, and the people benefit from his books in different languages all around the world. Thank you very much, dear listeners, and thank you much, Hujjat Hussam Ziyanian, Hujjat Hussam Mahtavi, for being present in the program. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Shian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah. Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name? Assalamu alaikum, ya Abu Abdullah.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still in Karbala, and we are trying to learn from the lessons of Karbala, from the University of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, when it comes to human rights. Imam Hussein salamullah alayhi, obviously one of his message, one of the first lessons he's trying to teach us, that we should not live with peace when it comes to oppressors. So living with peace with forces of oppression is absolutely wrong and rejected by Imam Hussein alayhi salam and by any logical person. So the Imam salamullah alayhi, he was the one who divided between good and evil. He's the one who divided between truth and falsehood. The Imam salamullah alayhi, he could have simply gave allegiance to Yazid. He could have saved himself. He could have saved his family's life. He could have saved a lot of people's lives if he just would have gave allegiance. In fact, he could have even got a position in the government, a very high, wealthy position, if he wanted, if he gave allegiance. But the Imam salamullah alayhi would not compromise on that. I mean, they said to the Imam, literally, they said to him, you know what, why don't you just stay, give allegiance, stay, fast and pray and do whatever you have, just give allegiance to Yazid, leave him alone. The Imam said, what's the point of my salah? What's the point of my fasting? What's the point of my prayer? Prayer itself and all these acts of worship, it is meant to show you the right path. It shows you right from wrong, truth from falsehood, good from evil. If I'm just, you know, supporting the oppressors, giving my allegiance, what good is my salah? What good is my prayer? What good is my fasting? What good is my reading the Quran? What good is my charity? It means nothing, because the ground and the foundation for good is not there anymore. So based on what am I praying? Based on what am I fasting? This need to lead me to somewhere good, because even Allah in the Quran says, "Inna salata tanha anil fahsha'i wal munkar." Prayer is supposed to do what? Its job is to make you refrain from creating